You're listening to Sweat, Snot and Tears, brought to you by Netmums. I'm Annie O'Leary.
And I'm Wendy Gollidge. And together we talk about all of this week's sweaty, snotty and tearful parenting moments.
With guests who are far more interesting than we are.
So with this week's guest, I more or less humiliated myself. I have been a fan for a long time. And I made that very clear in the beginning and then at the end asked if I could move in with her. Wendy, have I shamed you?
Yes, you have. I can't deny you were a little bit weird. But having said that, having just spent the last hour talking to Nadia Hussein, I think I might quite like her to adopt me too. She was so lovely.
Yeah, but she's not just lovely, is she? I don't meet people like that every day.
Honestly, I want to go and listen back to everything she said right away. She was just brilliant.
Yeah, it's kind of like a lessons to live by as much as it is just a bit of an entertaining chat about people and their kids, this one, don't you think?
Yep, elbows out, everybody.
Elbows out. Sweat, snot and teary types. I am sweating today because I really want this week's guest to adopt me. And if she doesn't feel the same way in an hour's time, I'm going to be heartbroken. Wendy, you need to help her get me to love me, okay?
No, not okay. It's over to you. All over to you. I'm sorry. It's all down to
me. Oh, well, thanks, mate. Okay, well, let's give this our best shot. Welcome to the Sweat, Snot and Tears podcast, Nadia Hussein.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Just been one of those mornings. I don't know. Yeah, I'm lucky that I even got here on time. Like the fact.
Tell us why. What's happened?
Well, we've just the kids have been really sick. My kids, I just always look at them and think, why are you always sick? What am I doing wrong? I pump them full of vitamins, lots of vegetables, you know, fresh air. I do all of that. Like if I could put them under a UV light, I would. And I can't. I just don't get it. So sometimes I feel really isolated when my kids are sick because I think, is it just me or are my kids always sick? But actually, when my kids come back from school, they're like, Mum, you know, so-and-so's off or there's 6 kids off school today or 8 kids off school. And at the moment, of course, the schools are being very, very cautious. Over the past 4 weeks that they've been in school, I've had one off every week. So we haven't actually, so we've had one off every week. And the thing is, if they get one little sniffle or the odd cough or a bit of a, you know, the school always rings and says, not feeling great, I think you should come and pick them up. So where the school are being overcautious and I'm at home, it's like, okay, well, we've just had them at home a lot.
It's such a hard balance to strike at the moment, isn't it? Between saying, come on, you're fine, go. And then also not wanting to alarm other people or alarm the teachers. Or it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just that little kind of, my boys have asthma. So they are prone to getting a cough when they're sick. The first thing that happens to them is they get this persistent cough. And I'm like, no,
you can do anything, but don't cough.
Anything.
Just don't cough.
Yeah, hold it in. And my son said, Mom, it's not like holding a fart in. You can't hold it in. I was like, he has a point. They say they're wise words from my teenagers. And it's true. He said, literally, he goes, I'm scared to cough. But when I hear other kids cough, I look at them. And I was like, don't look at people. They're allowed to cough. So, it's been really, really tricky. So it's every morning has been a bit of a rush here, there and everywhere trying to get them sorted. But we're getting there.
So I think we safely say there's been snot in your household this morning, but any special tears?
Yes, there has been a lot of snot. And I don't know about you guys, but do you find yourself retraining your children how to use the tissue properly every time they have a cold? I'm like, guys, so this is how, and my kids always laugh at me. They go, oh God, here's her tissue masterclass all over again. I do. There's been a lot of snot. There have been a lot of tears and there's been a lot of sweat on my behalf for sure, because it's been a lot of running around.
Okay, so what's a normal morning like in the Hussein household? We've heard what a bad day is like. What would a normal day be like? Is it calm and serene or is it, quick, get your shoes on, we've got to get out of the door?
Those are the days where it's kind of get this, do this, get up. It's a day when I wake up last. It's always manic when I wake up last. And maybe that's just giving myself way more credit than I'm due. But when I wake up and I try and journal every morning. So I give myself 5 minutes to wake up.
That's so healthy. That's so mindful. I love that.
It's only something I've started doing very recently because I've just found myself doing exactly what I don't want to do, which is waking up frantic. Because there's nothing worse than children going to school frantic, because you can sense it. Like, it takes them a little bit longer. It takes them longer. I always ask them, like, if we have a frantic morning, how do you feel? And they just come home the way they left. They'd never leave that kind of frantic state. So I find
You hate yourself all day. I kicked myself off on a day like that. I've sometimes gone into work and cried to Wendy and said, I gave them a really rubbish morning. I feel terrible.
You're both so much nicer than me. I'm just like, would you stop moaning and go to school? I'm feeling really bad.
Well, it's nice to know that we're not alone in that kind of that sadness, because sometimes I feel like the worst mother in the world, because sometimes I'll be like pointing my finger and having a go and saying, you need to do. And actually, it's me trying to, like, you know, if we do it and allow them enough room to learn and give them the lessons, you know, eventually proactiveness may come into play.
Well, I read a really interesting article on this once. Someone wrote a piece in the New York Times about it. They decided that mornings were becoming so fraught, this mum decided she was going to step back completely and let the dad do it. And she was like, and I was waiting for it to be a disaster and him to be shouting and him to understand the stress that I've been in for the last however many years. And instead, he took a completely different approach. And he said, kids, we're going to be leaving the house at 8:20. I'll meet you by the door. And they did it.
Does that irritate you a little bit? That just irritates me just a little bit.
Well, yeah, she said she wanted to kill him, but then she was like, you know what? What I wasn't doing was giving them enough credit to just get themselves together and get to the door. And he said that they were a little bit late for him, but he didn't hassle them. He just stood there, opened the door, was like, okay, we need to go now. And they scrambled and they did it.
Well, that just annoys me.
But where's your hairband? I told you you need your shoes. You know, I think my kids would go out the door naked if I did that.
Try it tomorrow and then let's see what happens.
Okay. Well, after this morning's pigtail related drama, I will report back. Pigtails were wonky, all my fault, usual.
You're a terrible mother, Wendy.
I am. Now, forget about mornings with kids, Nadia. Mm-hmm. What is for breakfast in your house?
Since the boys have become, you know, when they were younger, it was really, there was a system where we knew what we were having for breakfast and everybody was having the same thing. And what's really lovely now is that as they've become older, like sometimes my son will wake up and say, Mum, can I just have a green juice? And he'll whack a load of spinach and kale and bits and bobs in the Nutribullet and he'll just make himself a green smoothie, which I absolutely, like, yeah, that's fine if that's what you want to have. And it's quite nice because he'll wake up, my eldest will usually wake up and he'll make a green juice and at the tail end of the bits that he doesn't want, he then gives to his little brother who doesn't like green juices, but he says he should have it because it's good for him. And then, but mostly it's really simple. We are often, it's in the summer, it's toast. And as it gets colder, it's porridge.
Yes, I love a bit of porridge.
But you've got to tell us about your crumpet fixation. Come on.
Yes, I do have. I have an unhealthy relationship with crumpets. That's why I don't ever buy them, because it's just when I do, I don't really leave any for anyone else. And my daughter always comes home and says, I thought there were crumpets in the cupboard. And then I was like, that was me. But yes, I cannot understand. Like, for me, crumpets is, you know, when you put the butter on it and then it seeps all the way through, because it's basically a sponge, but a leaky one. And then it just goes all the way through. And so what I have is I have two crumpets, but I always have a backup third one underneath the other two, so that if there is any drippy meltage, it catches it. And then I re-butter that one and then I eat that, because nobody needs to waste butter. That's just not acceptable. There's no need for that. But I like to toast them till they're really crunchy and then leave them to go completely cold.
To go completely cold, but then the butter, it won't be melty butter.
Yes, then the butter doesn't melt. Then you get a thick layer of butter on top. And then I do one with Marmite and then I do one with jam.
Okay, you've revolutionised this. I'm going to have to go and try this later. It's never occurred to me to do anything but melty butter.
No, unmelt it. Don't do the melty thing. It's really nice. It's really...
I'm not sure this all...
We'll try it and we'll report back. Okay. So...
Report back.
We will report back. Now, tell us, how old are your kids now and what phases are they in? Like, let us picture the scene in the Hussein household.
So I've got two boys and the eldest is 14 and then my second son is 13 and my little girl just turned 10.
Right.
So we're in double digits. So I had a good cry. Yeah. My little girl was 10 this weekend. Aww. And I dropped her off to her dance class and her acting class. And then I dropped her off and I had a little cry in the car. I tried not to cry in front of her. Aww. And she kept saying, you're not going to cry, are you, mummy? Almost willing it on. And I was like, no, no, I'm not going to cry. I'm fine. And then I sat in the car and had a little blubber. I just, there was something about them becoming, the last one becoming double digits. She's lost all her baby teeth. So she's this little person with really big teeth and it's really cute. But my eldest is very much like any teenager. He gets grumpy. He huffs and puffs a little bit, but oh my goodness, completely and utterly mushy. Like, he loves a good hug and he loves a good...
That's nice to hear.
And loves a good chat. And it's like, mummy, do you want a cup of tea? Which usually means he wants a cup of tea. So he'll make himself one and then he'll make me one. In so many ways, he's unlike any 14-year-old in that he is so sentimental and really sweet and really kind of conscientious. And he thinks about everything. He's a big thinker. But equally, he's also really grumpy and huffs and puffs and gives me like grunts for answers. And then we've got the 13-year-old who is like the most sprightly human being you've ever met. Does not like anything where it requires him to stand in front of anyone. Hates being the center of attention. Although he was the same child from the age of about 2 to about 10, wore bow ties and shirts to every play date.
Oh, that's so cute.
Oh my goodness.
The day that's amazing. I love that.
With his little braces and his trousers and his little half shirts and his little bow tie. And he turned 10 and he just said, Mummy, I don't like bow ties anymore. And that broke my heart also. But he's not yet hit that hideous grumpy stage yet. He's really lively. He's really kind of, he's really funny. He's really, really funny. So he keeps us laughing. And my little girl, she's into musical theatre.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she was in Les Mis a few years ago. So about a year and a half ago, she was in Les Mis for 6 weeks. So she's got an amazing, amazing singing voice. But there's this idea that children who are in musical theatre might be a little bit sassy. Well, that definitely rings true with her because she is... But her life is musical theatre. She sings through life, like every aspect of her life. If she's ironing, then she will be singing. If she's...
Hang on, back up. Your 10-year-old is ironing?
I know, I'm impressed by this, Nadia. Tell us your secret. I want mine to be doing this.
Oh, it's called making demands. I just say you have to do it and they don't really argue. Well, yeah, no, my, they do. We have, Friday night is ironing night. So Friday night they do all the ironing. So they put it in piles and everybody does their own ironing. And I don't know she loves ironing. So she'll always do mine as well, which I don't mind. And I've had to get over that a little bit that they don't iron the way I do, but at least they do it. And you have to kind of almost let your standards slip just a little bit to allow them to do it.
You've got to let it go. Like mine wouldn't know where the iron is. They wouldn't know what it is. They wouldn't know what to do with it if they found it. And you're worrying that yours aren't doing it to the right standard.
It's fabulous. What age would you say is good to start ironing? Mine are 8 and 6, Nadia. Do you think it's time?
I couldn't give you a right or wrong answer because I suppose it's each individual child and nobody.
Yeah, whether they're ready.
Yeah, and I have to say my little boy's been ironing since he was 6.
That's great.
And he's 14 now, very confident.
I do think there's something very important about upskilling your kids so that they can look after themselves one day. You don't want them to be the annoying kid in the house show at university who can't boil an egg or iron their own jeans.
I suppose the hope is one day that when they go off and have their own lives, that they will bring, you know, I just want them to just be ready for the world, I suppose.
I agree with you.
And I think when you can do things like simple things like ironing that feel very grown up, I think it gives you this independence that nothing else really can. And I don't find it because we grew up and we had to just get on with everything. But that being said, you know, I was raised in a family where the girls were taught to cook and clean and tidy up, but we had to cook and clean and tidy up after our brothers. So they never learned how to do all of those things.
Yeah, that wouldn't work for me, no.
No, so the skill has to be kind of all around. Everybody has to know how to do it. And they, you know, on a Sunday, they spend 3 hours dusting the house and they hate it. They absolutely hate it, but they have to do it because there is no, that's not what Sundays are not for. You can have a moment to rest on a Sunday, but there's 3 hours of house cleaning that needs doing. And they will do everything. Radiators, skirting boards, tops of doors, the lot. You name it. They hate it. They absolutely hate it. We have a playlist. We listen to the playlist over and over again, but they do it. They have to hoover, they have to dust, and they have to clean the bathrooms and toilets, the lot, mopping, everything, all of it. They have to do it. So no choice, no choice. They are nature's workers. That's what I say. I made them.
I like that.
Yeah, and they're nature's little workers.
Yeah, and choice is overrated anyway.
We always ask our guests to talk about their births. So which of yours was the most memorable? We're taking you back from the teenage years to the squidgy newborns. Who was the most memorable birth and why?
I mean, I suppose he didn't put me off because it was a horrendous birth.
Oh, no.
But my eldest, perhaps. But I think the first is always probably the most memorable, I suppose, in some ways. But they were all memorable for different reasons. But my first, I think, because I had a hideously long, I was in active labor for 72 hours.
Oh, my goodness. That's horrendous.
And I remember after having him, the midwife said, oh, we'll see you next year. And I was like, no, you won't. And there was I exactly a year and 6 days to the day, I was back in that same hospital.
Oh, wow. She just knew.
She said, you can't have a baby like him and not have another one. And he was just beautiful and just squidgy and gorgeous. But it was a horrific labor. I had fourth degree tears. It was just hideous.
Tell me they got better after that. Tell me the next two were better.
The time shortened very, very slightly. I mean, my third and final labor was 48 hours. So it wasn't like they got that much shorter. So I'm obviously just, my body just likes to drag things out, but they did get easier each time. And I was like, please, please, no stitches. I don't want stitches. I remember saying to during my third labor, and weirdly, she was the biggest of all of them. She was 8'13", so she was massive. She was a big baby and nothing. I had no stitches, nothing. I walked out there and I'm like, I'm going to Tesco. And I went off. There I was, just like, no stitches. I felt so free compared to my first labor, but all memorable in different ways, but horrific.
Everyone's first, I think, is slightly traumatizing because you just don't know what to expect. Like, you can watch as many episodes of One Born Every Minute as there are, but it's nothing really prepares you for the real thing, does it?
No, because you never really see what's going on down there.
No.
Because if there was a way of seeing what, and I wish I had, I kind of feel like I've missed out because I wish I had seen what was going on down there. Because there's one thing when you're watching it from a different perspective and you're looking from a television screen, it doesn't feel real till you're in that moment and you're there trying to push a human out of your body. Just not quite. And it's the expressions, actually the thing I remember the most is the expression on my husband's face.
Were they horrified?
Well, there were moments where he was like, oh, you're doing really well. You could see, and you just, you kind of focus, you need to focus in on something. And often it was just his face that I was focusing in on. And his expressions would change occasionally. And then there were moments when they couldn't find his heartbeat or it was dipping or slowing. It was the look on his face. And I'd say, what's wrong? What's wrong? And, or if he's smiling, I'm like, what are you smiling about? What, you know, so it was so much of how I felt was dictated by my husband's face. So I could, there was a moment where he would just like fake smile and he was like, I was like, no, that's not real. What's wrong? So definitely that was definitely the most memorable of the three.
And was motherhood something that you felt predestined for? Like growing up, did you always think, and obviously I want to become a mum? Or was it something that came to you after you got married? Or how did it happen for you?
I grew up in a family, a big family, a massive extended family. And that's how, in our culture, that's how family works. You're not nuclear. There's no such thing. There's grandparents, there's uncles, there's aunts, there's relatives. They are all family. No, you don't get to ever say it's just me and my family. It just doesn't work that way. And so growing up in such an enormous family, as lovely as it was bright and colorful. And we were never alone. It was always just something every weekend. And that was lovely, but it put me off completely. I was just like, no.
Really?
I'm one of six. So, and my husband's one of seven. So that was a kind of a standard size of a family back then. And I hated it. Like, I remember trying to prop up the ironing board to do my homework because there was no space anywhere. And my cousins were downstairs and I would kick them out. And they were all like, I was doing my GCSEs and I had cousins who were younger than me and just really just at the time, just not very interesting or fun. And I didn't like them very much. It was just like, you know, you just never get a moment to yourself. So I remember growing up thinking, I don't know that I'll get married. And I definitely do. I just did not want kids at all.
So then what changed your mind?
Well, when I found my husband, I was like, oh, he'd actually make quite a good dad.
Oh, he softened you.
Changed you.
Yeah, he did. It was, it just, I was like, he would make, because in our religion, we're raised to believe that you don't just look for a husband, you look for a good father to your children.
I think that's such a lovely sentiment. I think that's how everyone should think.
Yeah, and I think when I met him and we got married, we said, look, maybe we might have kids one day. And then I was like, oh my goodness, he's so good. He's so good with my nephew, so good with his nephew and niece. I just thought, oh, I think he'd be quite a good dad. But we were always really open for adoption and, you know, something that we're always thinking about, because as our kids get older, we'd love to be in a position. To hopefully maybe give somebody else a home, because we have the space for it. It'd be lovely in our heart and our home. So it'd be nice maybe one day.
Is that something that's definitely on your radar then? It's something you think you might consider later on?
Yeah, it's something that we will definitely consider at some point. And we talk about it all the time. And I think because we talk about it, it is something that's on our radar all the time. And it just seems that life kind of almost gets in the way. And I think that once we're kind of emotionally in the right place for something like that, I think we will do it. Because we do, like, we've got so much love to give and we've got space in our home for some more children. And it just, like, it feels, I'm at a point now where I've had three children where I just watched David Attenborough's documentary.
We've all been watching that.
Yes. And there was this thing about population. And I was like, should I feel guilty that I've got three kids? And my son said, do you feel guilty now that you've destroyed the planet with three children? And I was like,
it's all your fault, Nadia.
I was like, hey, watch it. I've had you. You're here now. So yeah, I think there are children out there, and we've got friends that have adopted. So I think as we've seen other people do it, we've definitely thought about it more. So yes, maybe in the future, it's something we always think about.
Yeah, my cousin's just adopted, and I think it's one of the most inspiring things that I've ever seen. I think when you see it in real life up close, it really does make you think, wow, mm-hmm. What an amazing thing to do.
Yeah, such a selfless thing to do.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Now, you've become kind of the national poster woman for women discovering themselves and facing their fears in order to sort of triumph and push themselves forward. Do you feel like that person? Do you wake up every morning and think, oh my God, everyone's looking at me to inspire them? And has that confidence grown with your fame, or does it feel a bit weird to you?
It still does feel really surreal and odd at times, because I am literally, as I talk to you, I'm in my spare bedroom on the floor because I've just sold the bed on Gumtree, got rid of it.
That's all good women do.
Yeah, because I was like, there, nobody sleeps in this bed. Nobody's ever slept, not really, apart from my brother occasionally. Like, nobody uses this spare bedroom. So what is it sat here for? So I'm sat here on the floor thinking about colours that I want to turn to paint this room. So when I think about myself as a role model or somebody that people are inspired by, I don't know, it's not something that I think about very much. And when I do think about it, it feels a little bit weird and odd, because I just don't feel like that person. Because ultimately, when I had children, my role was always ever to be the best role model to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been catapulted in this weird and wonderful world. And with it comes big responsibility, because to me, it's not just a job. And I suppose I've taken that on, and I've definitely accepted it more over the last five years. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I definitely wouldn't give you the answers I'm giving you now, because I would have said, no, I just want to cook and I just want to bake. And please just ask me those questions. Don't talk to me about politics. Don't talk to me about race or religion or identity. But I know how important that is, because growing up, I didn't see someone like me in publishing, in television, in the media. So when I watch myself back, I realize the importance of doing what I do. So yeah, it is unusual, but I understand the significance and the importance of it.
Because your lack of confidence wasn't like a minor issue. You were actually having anxiety attacks filming Bake Off, weren't you? So it's something so many of our users in the forum discuss. How did it start, and how have you got a handle on it now?
Yeah, that's something that really took me, it took me a while to think about whether I want, I thought about it for a long time about how much I wanted to talk about my anxiety, because it's something that I've been riddled with it since the age of 7. And I just, no matter what I do and what I've tried, I can't be rid of it. And it's just, it's something that I know that I've learned to kind of almost live with. And what I find, having done this for 5 years, there's something that I find really odd about the kind of comparison between success and fragility. And the thing is, the one thing I've learned about myself is that you can be successful, you can be confident and be fragile at the same time.
Absolutely.
And that's something that I fought with myself quite a lot over the last 5 years. I used to think, oh, well, if people think I'm successful, surely I have to appear like I have everything. I have to appear like I'm strong, that I don't have weaknesses in myself, and that I don't second guess my relationship with my family or my husband or my children, or that I don't have or my own mental health issues that I deal with every single day. You know, like now that I've just come to accept the fact that actually I can be successful and fragile at the same time makes this journey so much easier for me. And I think that's like anyone who is suffering with anxiety or is struggling with the two together. Like I genuinely believe that you can be really successful, be really motivated and be fragile and have mental health issues at the same time. And I've come to accept that. And actually that's made me even more successful and even more strong in what I do. And that's why I'm really open about it, because I think somebody somewhere has put the idea into our heads that you can't have both, and you can be both.
So did you talk to your kids about anxiety? How do you frame it for them?
I hadn't really spoken to them about mental health issues till about 4 years ago. And the kids would often ask their dad, like they would say, oh, is mum not, it just became normal for them to, they'd ask, oh, is mum just a little bit sad today? Or is she just feeling a bit tired? So often they would say, is mummy tired today? And when they say tired, you know, I was losing weekends, weeks, days, you know, with my children because I was in bed, because I couldn't physically get out of bed. And they'd say, oh, mummy's just tired today. And that they grew up just watching me be very tired all the time. And about 4.5 years ago, I just sat down and I just said, look, this is what I have, this is what I feel, and just kind of explained it to them. And actually, something I realized about myself when I hadn't told them and where I'd made the decision to tell them was that I'd spent a lot of years lying to my children. And I was my own, like I was contradicting myself more than anyone I knew. Like everything that I was teaching my children, I was doing the complete opposite. And actually, I think there's strength in telling the truth. And of course, I kind of told them the bits that they needed to know. And as they become older, they definitely know more about me than they did before. And that's, it's only a conversation I had with them last weekend, is I said, I think it's time you guys learned and understood that we all made sacrifices to be where we are today. And we've all had tough journeys. And I think it's time you start to learn about the journeys. And by that, I don't just mean myself. I mean, my grandparents, my own parents, who have all, as immigrants, have suffered and struggled to get us where we are today. And I always tell them, I'm paying it forward through you guys, but you have to remember that we have to pay it backwards too. So you have to understand what happened back then. So there is a wisdom in being honest to your children. And it's definitely helped me to better understand myself.
One of the things that I'm really intrigued about is that I listened to another interview with you where you said that you try and have a little check-in each day with your kids to kind of see how they're feeling about things and talk about the bigger issues in life, including death, and kind of reminding them that all of our days are numbered and we've got to make a difference in the days that we're living. Can you tell us a bit about that and how you kind of came to think that and want to share that with them?
I think being a part of a religion, so being a Muslim, being honest about death is really important. And they've never really experienced grief as such, where they haven't, thank goodness, haven't lost anybody very close to them. And my little boy, he had a friend and a distant relative who actually, when he was four, died. The little boy died at the age of four. So we had to explain death very early on because we'd only just seen him 7 or 8 days before, and then he got sick, and then he died. And so it was very sudden. And so at the age of four, we had to explain to our little boy what it meant to die, and that death meant not coming back, and how it affected the parents, and what it meant and what it means from a religious perspective also. Actually, they're a little bit, what I love about them now is they're very matter of fact. And I think now when they're hesitant to do something, sometimes my little boy will say, my eldest will say, we could be dead tomorrow, guys. Should we just do this? And then we just do it. And I love that they understand that tomorrow isn't guaranteed.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I don't know if that's just Western culture, but I think growing up in England, I used to always be quite, you know, in certain crowds, I'd be quite nervous about talking openly about death or mortality, because I feel like there's this kind of like, we don't talk about that. And I find it really liberating talking about death.
I think lots of people are scared to talk about it in a way that you're clearly not, which is really refreshing.
I think actually lockdown and COVID has made yes. people have a few more conversations about this. I think it's something people have had to face more. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. One nail on the head for sure. During lockdown, we've had to have really difficult conversations about a family friend has passed away. Two family friends have passed away of COVID over the last few months. We've had like my grandma and her brother and some of our relatives they got stranded out in Bangladesh when they couldn't come back. So we'd kind of explain why great granny couldn't come back. We've had people get sick. So my brother-in-law got sick with COVID. My father-in-law recently had quadruple heart bypass. So we were really worried about him. So really talking about all the things that it's quite a lot, I think, for children to take on, because they were suddenly worrying about the things that most of us adults take on and don't talk to our kids about because we want to protect them. And we've had to have quite interesting, difficult conversations with the kids. And what I found really just heartwarming about the whole thing was that roles reversed just a little bit, where my kids have definitely in the last 7 months learned how to be more nurturing in it, and the other way around towards me and their dad, where we would normally be the ones to prop them up and make sure that they're okay. You know, I found my kids asking me, "Hey, Mum, are you okay today?"
That's really interesting.
I found that really heartwarming that actually they were doing, clearly our children are learning the things that we do to them. They're mimicking those things.
Well, they're learning empathy, and empathy is surely one of the greatest things you'd want them to have in their life, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's that, even for myself, like I think where I would, my mum would say things to me where she would want to keep an eye on me and make sure that I am protected. I think as they get older, we're doing it anyway, but I found myself doing it quite a lot with my mum. And let me tell you, during lockdown, it is not easy grounding your parents.
We've all struggled with that one.
Oh, yeah. Goodness. I'm like, Mum, you're grounded. And she's a key worker. So she's like, you need me. Everybody needs me. I can't stop. And she hasn't. She's worked all through lockdown, hasn't had a moment, 6 days a week, 12-hour shifts, working all the time. So super proud of my mum, because she's a complete superhero, complete legend.
Big cheer for Nadia's mum.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing. She cleans linen in a factory where they clean hospital linen.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Such a vital job right now.
And she keeps telling me, don't tell anyone. So I was like, no, I'm going to crowbar that conversation into every podcast, Mum, because I'm really proud of you. And people don't realize that people like my mum, an immigrant who doesn't speak very much English, and all her colleagues are immigrants, every single one of them, they all worked really hard through the lockdown. And I'm so proud of everything that they've done, because they've worked really hard to keep our country going. And I'm like, no, no, Mum, I'm going to crowbar that into every conversation. So we're really proud of that.
It's people like your mum that kept the world turning. Like, it's those jobs that matter.
It's those unlikely heroes. And she's definitely one of them. And so I tried to ground my dad, and he just said, I am never going to listen to you. And if I am going to listen to you, it's going to cost you. And I was like, no, Dad. No, but he doesn't listen. He doesn't listen. He does not.
Oh, none of them do. They're a very willful generation, that generation.
They really are. They're like, what, COVID? I'm like, Dad, you can't say that. It's real.
It's like having to parent two generations at once, isn't it, sometimes?
And then I just do the whole emotional thing, and I get my kids to call and say, Grandad, Nana, we don't want you to die. And that's
oh, you're good.
Yeah.
That's when they listen.
No shame.
Yep.
So, Nadia, do you think part of your desire to teach your kids about embracing life today and not counting on tomorrow is connected to the illnesses of your siblings, what they dealt with as children? I've read that you used to say their names out loud before you went to sleep at night to ward off their deaths.
Yes.
Personally have a very sick sibling as well, so it definitely altered and shaped me growing up, and I'm just really interested in that part of you.
Yeah, I don't think I ever acknowledged the effect having sick siblings had on me, because I think when you've got sick brothers and sisters who are in and out of hospital quite a lot, and often with my sister, it was life or death. And with my brother, it was very kind of aesthetic. So some of the things that, you know, he would come home and he'd be, it would be hard to look him in the eyes because he looked so different and sometimes quite scary. So it was, you know, as a child of, you know, not even double digits, we had to learn perspective quite quickly. And I think it definitely shaped who I am and certainly my other siblings, because there's a point where you have to kind of ask yourself, is what I'm about to say as important as what's happening right now? And so you learn to not share things that are affecting you or that are important to you in that moment. Because when you're 7 or 8 or you're being bullied or somebody's being mean to you, that's your world and that's what matters in that moment. But when you've got a 6 sibling, you kind of have to ask yourself, well, like, I'm not on death's door. I'm not having an operation where I'm going to be unrecognizable after they're done with me. So is it really worth telling my mom right now that somebody said something really mean to me? So I think quite early on, you learn perspective. And I think you have to grow up much faster than all your peers and everybody around you, where, you know, girls around me were playing with Barbie dolls. I was sat in bed saying my brothers and sisters' names because I thought that that would be the thing that kept them alive. And it created a kind of repetitive behavior in me that, you know, I clearly needed diagnosing with something. There was definitely, I certainly had issues. And every time I loved somebody, they were on that list. And the list just got bigger and bigger. I had to then tell myself, I remember as a child, that stop loving people, because if you love them and then they have to die.
Bad.
Yeah. And so I would tell myself that you only have 10 fingers and between you, there's 8 people. And the only other person, like I remember culling people off the list at some point, and then
ruthless.
Yeah, I know. 10 fingers. I've only got room for 10 people, and I never put myself on the list. But my nan was on the list, and I even put my granddad on the list in the hope that if I said his name enough times, he might come back, and things like that. Yeah. And so, what I taught myself at a young age was that don't love people, because if you love them, they're just like, when they go, it'll hurt. And I've been really lucky because everybody close to me is still around, and I still have my granny who's like ripe old age of 90, who's hilariously wonderful and still recognizes my voice when I ring her, which I think is not bad when you've got 40 grandchildren.
40? Wow, that's impressive.
I'm one of 67, I'm going to say, on my dad's side, one of 67 grandkids on my dad's side. That's the last time I counted. I don't know who else has had babies.
7, wow.
Lucky we don't celebrate Christmas, right?
That raises another question that I was going to ask you. Are you very aware that you're a Muslim mum raising children of colour in a country that I'm ashamed to say is struggling a bit with its identity as a multicultural, multiracial country? Or do you just try and soldier on regardless? Like, how do you deal with your consciousness around that?
Growing up, I didn't really question my identity till I was in a situation where my surroundings were more representative of the UK that I know, which is multicultural. But I grew up in a very kind of Muslim heavy school, be it high school, primary school, and even up to college. And it was really when I went to work, I realized that actually the world is very multicultural, and the world we live in is very mixed. And it's something that I didn't really deal with, and I didn't really think about, to be honest. But I did. There were little things that would happen where I would walk in a room and I could kind of almost feel the silence. Or there were situations where, now that I look back, where I went in for a job interview. I remember going in for a hand modeling interview, and it was to
model. Modeling. That's all.
Yeah, hand modeling for jewellery. And it was back in the day when they used to have these little kind of paper ads in the newspaper. And I would look, and I was desperate for a part-time job. And I remember going to this job interview, and I came in, and she said, that's all she did. I kind of went in and went to take the form, room full of women. And I said, she just looked at me. She said, And then she kind of took me to a corner, but spoke loud enough so that everybody in the room could hear. And she just said, I'm afraid that I can't take your application. And then I said, why? And she said, because unfortunately, brown hands don't sell jewelry.
Oh, Jesus.
So that's, I think, that was the first time in my life I'd experienced something where, because of the color of my skin, I wasn't able to do what everybody else could do. And that's why I have this thing with wearing jewelry. I just really struggle with it because I'm like, it doesn't.
So it's really affected you. It's kind of stayed with you in a huge way.
Yeah, I don't even wear my wedding rings because I just think that sometimes I just, my hands just look really ugly to me. And ever since that Stop. Kind of, so yes, raising children in a society where they will stand out because, I mean, they're Muslim, they're young Muslim children of color, and they will, there's going to be a point in their life. And I don't shy away from that. And I say, look, I pray that you guys live in a world where you will, the color of your skin or your religion won't come into play, and you can be just on a level playing field with everybody else. And the reality is that I just think we're so far away from that world that I just can't see anything changing for my children. But what I can do as a woman of color and as a woman and as a Muslim one, the only thing I can do is knock some of those hurdles down for them. And I'm hoping that by doing the job that I do and by representing myself within publication, within television, I can say, well, actually, you know, no, there isn't space for me, but I'm going to make space for me. And I think that's really important.
It is.
The one thing I tell my children is that the world may not have been made for us, but one thing you have to always remember is that we have this mantra in our house, and it's, we say elbows out to each other. So in those moments where they feel like they don't fit in, or they're unsure because of who they are or because of the religion they are a part of, I always tell them elbows out. And that's like, if you think about it physically, but if you think about it, like if you think about the action of sticking your elbows out, you're creating space for yourself. And I always tell them, if there's no space for you, create space for you, because in doing that, you're going to create space for others. And that's kind of what I tell myself every single day when I don't fit in, because the truth is I don't fit in this world. I don't fit in the industries that I work in, because when I'm filming and I look back at everybody else behind the cameras with the sound, the runners, everyone, there is not one person of color. I have worked in teams of 40, 50 people, and I'm the only person of color in the room. There's something wrong with television. There's something wrong with publication. When somebody tells me, actually, the topic that you want to write about is not going to sell enough books because nobody's going to want to learn about parenting from you because you're not white. So that's not, so that's the kind of thing that I have to deal with. That's the kind of stuff that I have to face every single day. And I have to take that knockback and that rejection and find myself doing the same thing somewhere else, because I don't believe that the whole world is full of hatred and that there are people out there who are trying to make those changes. And I will find the right home for myself wherever I go, with people who are willing to make changes in this, in these industries.
You can't see me, but while you were saying all of that, I was smiling and nodding and almost punching the air. Like, come on, Nadia, this is why we love you. You're amazing. Now, I must say, in the same spirit, I was absolutely blown away by your book, Finding My Voice.
Yeah.
You shared very bravely and candidly and with actual kind of quite a remarkable grace how you were sexually abused as a child. Where did you find the courage to go public with that story? You must have agonized about the impact it would have on your parents, your extended family, your children. Where does that come from?
That was like torture. It felt like torture to me, because it was something that I'd written into the book, then written out. And I did that 6 or 7 times, and I wrote it in, and then I wrote it out, and then I wrote it in. And then I said to my husband, I have to talk to you about something. So I sat down in his office, and honestly, I like, often when he's in the office, I just blabber on and he carries on working. And I said, no, you're gonna have to turn around for this. So he turned around, and I said, I don't think I can put this in. I don't know how it's gonna affect the kids. And he said, what's the worst that'll happen? And I said, I just feel like I don't want them to judge me. And he said, isn't that part of the problem? Isn't that the problem, that you have already put that judgment on yourself and you've decided that it's too shameful to share with your children? Surely it's an education that our children need, that you could have done with years and years ago as a child yourself, about what is right, what is wrong, and what is acceptable and what isn't. And actually, he was right. And he just said,
I'm very wise. He said, like, we all need his advice.
And he just said, who are you writing this book for? And that's a big question for me. And I think that was when I really, really put some welly into writing the book, thinking, you know what, actually, who am I writing this book for? And as much as it's a memoir of snippets, tiny, tiny snippets of my relationships and my roles, I had to really question who I was writing this book for. And actually, this book was written for all of those people who don't have a voice, all of those people who have been abused and haven't had the courage to say something, all of those people who question their identity and what they say and what it means and what it means to say those things. And I realized at that point, as soon as he asked me that question, that this book is so much more than just my voice. And I know from the hundreds of people that I've bought the book, that have read the book, they have found some sort of courage that we are all built with. We have that courage somewhere. We just sometimes, like, that voice sits at the tip of our tongue or heavy on our chest, but it's there and we have to find it. And I'm not saying that I can scream and shout and be confident and say things all the time. But in that moment, when I'd written it out, I wrote it right back in and I sent it to the editor and I said, that's it. It's gone. Don't give it back to me anymore. That's it. Just don't. And they didn't even edit it. They just exactly word for word, exactly as I'd written it. She just said, this doesn't need editing. It's exactly as it should be. And it was just, it was uplifting for me. Felt like I'd lifted a load off my shoulders. And you were saying, you know, like how it would affect my family. And actually, for me, certainly the sexual abuse is something that's such a taboo subject that happens so frequently within our culture. And I'm sure, and I can only speak for my own community and my own culture, but it is something that happens every single day. Everybody that I know that has been close to me in friendship and in family, everybody I know has suffered some form of abuse. And it's kept quiet and swept under the rug because it's not something that nobody wants to bring shame to the family.
One wants to bring shame. And I think no one knows what to do. I think people are sort of paralyzed by it, aren't they?
I mean, I know what I would do, but I mean,
well, me too.
I don't know if I can say it on here, but yeah, I know what I would do. And I just think that because of the approval of elders and approval of community, that word community, as much as I love it, I despise it at the same time because
carries a heavy weight as well, doesn't it?
It does. It has been the downfall for many of us, the whole answering to a community, the whole being a part of this group where there are these unspoken rules that some of us were never really going to fit in with. And so my teenagers have both read the book and they both just hugged me and said, if I could find the little 5-6-year-old you, I would give her a hug and say it's going to be okay. And that for me was one of the best moments of my life because my kids saw a part of me and I allowed myself to be vulnerable to my own children. And that makes me not just vulnerable, it also makes me the mom I want to be, which is the honest one.
It makes you vulnerable and strong all at the same time. And that's the goal, isn't it? That's the goal, to be real. Mm-hmm. Everyone has strong bits and weak bits. That's what being a human is.
Exactly.
So is there any part of you that you still keep back, or is that kind of a form of control you don't think you need anymore? I guess, is there anything we don't know about you, Nadia?
No, I mean, I suppose I don't really have... I mean, we shouldn't say everything we think. That's something I've always taught my kids. I just always say, look, just because you think...
I'm definitely not saying
anything. I mean, if I said everything I thought, but...
I think I'd be locked up.
But I always tell my kids, like, you don't have to... It's that attitude of, I am who I am, take it or leave it. I'm not that person. I'm not that person because I do believe as an adult that we all should have some sort of filter. We have to learn how to navigate ourselves in different situations. And that's something I'm trying to teach my children, is that the things, like, for instance, there's certain things that they can say in front of me to me that are completely acceptable in our home, but not necessarily acceptable in my mom's house because she's of a different generation. So, like, in our culture, the kids cannot use each other's names. They have, they have words to say older brother. We have words to say little sister. So they don't use each other's names. And that's just a form of respect. And whilst it may feel archaic for lots of people, it's a tradition that I'm happy to keep going because actually it's really sweet. It's really sweet because you can't have a go at somebody when you've got such a lovely pet name for them, if you know what I mean. Like, you can't have a go at them and then say... So there's a wisdom in certain
ways. It's interesting. That is interesting.
Because if, for instance, there's things like, in our culture, I can't say my husband's name.
So what do you call him?
So I call him so-and-so's dad in front of my parents. So I'll say like Musa's dad or Dawood's dad or Mariam's dad. If I'm talking about him, I would never say Abdal because it would literally, my mum would, like, honestly, I'm sure she would throttle me if I did that. She would kill me. she would, it's just not done. I have never heard my mother, who is not even, she's not even 60 yet. My goodness, she's quite young. I just realized. But yeah, she, I have never heard my mum ever, ever in her life say my dad's name.
Yeah. All families have little sore points that they know. Like you say, your mum's nearly 60 and you're this grown, you know, fabulous woman. But we all still have certain things we wouldn't dare do in front of our parents. It's fascinating. Well,
absolutely. Like the other, about a week ago, I had a haircut and I went from kind of mid-back length, curly, big hair to completely almost pixie. Like,
oh,
just
wow.
Yeah, so like shaved sides, like nice. Just curly top. Oh my goodness, I did it. And my first thing, my sister said, oh my God, that's really edgy. You look really cool. Have you shown mum yet? And I was like, no. I said, don't be ridiculous. I'm going to let it grow out a little bit before I show mum. And she said, okay, that's fine. You know what she did? As soon as she got off the phone from me, she texted the image to my mum's house. But because she could see she could see my mum hadn't seen the message, she went round and showed her. And I said, you cow. And then she called me on FaceTime and I thought it was her ringing me. And there's my mum's face. And she goes,
oh no.
She said, I've seen what you've done to your hair. And she said,
did she freak?
She said, you look like a boy.
Oh,
and I didn't say anything. And I said, do you like it? And she said, we'll see what it looks like when it grows out. I was like, okay.
We all still want approval from our parents, no matter how old we are, don't we? What do you want Nadia Hussain to be most remembered for? Is it a trailblazer for women everywhere? Is it just the best mum to your kids? Is it the best cook? Is it survivor? What is it that Nadia wants to be remembered for?
I think I would. That's a really good question. And I've been asked that a couple of times. And I think if I was going to be remembered as anything, I would like to be remembered as the maker of space. I don't want anyone to remember my name.
Ooh, what a fabulous answer.
I don't want anyone to remember my name. I don't care if I am erased from Wikipedia forever. I don't care if there's not one book left in the land with my name or my picture on it. I want to be known as the person who refused to be pushed out of an industry that she doesn't belong in. And I want to be the person that says she was resilient enough to stick her elbows out so far for so long that she created space for others. And that's what I would like my legacy to be.
I think I'm going to cry. I know. That's pretty profound, Nadia.
Elbows out is staying with me. I'm keeping.
I might get a tattoo, Nadia.
Oh! Don't tell your mum.
Yeah, no, she'd go mental.
So, Nadia, final question, and it's a little bit weird. And usually I make Annie ask this one because I hate asking it. But please, will you imagine that you're putting Annie and I to bed and sing us your lullaby?
Because every family has a little song that they sing to their kids when they can't sleep, and we love hearing what they are.
Oh, so I don't actually, when my kids can't sleep, I do this thing, and it's really weird. Now that you said it, I'm imagining you guys, and I'm like doing it to you.
And,
like,
and you're slightly creeped out, apologies.
So I do this thing where so when they sleep, they like to be really, really like tucked in. And then so I do this thing where I don't sing them lullabies. It's really weird because it's actually my husband that does the singing of lullabies because he's got an amazing singing voice and plays the guitar. So I can't really match that. So he plays them guitar every night. And he sings like Disney songs every single night, which is really
interesting.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't have time for anything. Very rarely makes eye contact when he's working. But he will get up and he's like dad of the year singing Disney songs and playing the guitar. I can't even play a triangle if I tried. But I do this thing with my kids where I look over them and then I kind of I do this thing where I tuck from their shoulders with their blanket. And then you just imagine it like kind of like from their shoulders, tuck the blanket under them and just keep saying tuck, 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 tuck. And it's really cute because I've done this to them since they were really little, because as they know, the closer I get to their toes, like that's the point where I would tickle them and they'll untuck themselves, even though I've done a really good job of tucking them. So I go tuck, tuck, tuck all the way. So shoulders, elbows, hands, all the way down their thighs. And then as I get to their knees, they start to wriggle a little bit and they're like, oh, no, no, no. oh no, 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 she's getting to our toes. And then I was like, tuck, 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 tuck. And then I get to their toes and then I just like squiggle their toes. I still do it to the 14-year-old and he finds it hilarious. He's going to hate that. I've said that. But it's always tuck, 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 toes.
Oh, Nadia. I love all of this. So last question of all from me, will you adopt me now? You said you wanted to adopt someone.
Well, I am in the spare bedroom, which is getting a redecorate. So I'm just saying, like,
There could be room. Let's keep talking.
If gentleman's grey is your colour, then you can come and move in.
I'll put up with any colour. Right, great. Thank you so much, Nadi. You've been an absolute inspiration to have on the show.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to take Annie away before she gets creepy.
Have an amazing day, guys.
And you. Take care, Nadia. Thank you.
Bye.